This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Mackinac Center analyst Michael Lefebvre explains why he thinks Michigan won by losing out to Wisconsin in an effort to lure a new Foxconn plant to the state, and why Michigan economic development officials shouldn't offer any special incentives on another Foxconn project. But first, it will soon be time to go back to school. Some kids may be nervous if they're going to a different school than they did last year, or just by the prospect of moving up a grade. In the latest issue of FYI magazine, writer Ann Lape tells us that butterflies are normal, but she also introduces us to some children and their families who have suffered from anxiety that made school and learning more difficult. We learn how parents can help children cope and how anxiety in children can be treated. Ann Lape is also a teacher, and she joins us to discuss her story for FYI, Anxiety and Kids. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What made you want to write this story?
It started with a very personal experience. We have a 16-year-old son who has struggled, and the more I talked to other parents, I found that we were not alone. And in helping our son, I wanted to talk with other parents and let other parents know that they weren't alone either.
As you tell us in the story, or as the editors tell us in the story, the names here have been changed of the children and their parents. Even with that, was it difficult to get families to talk about this?
Letting them know that their children wouldn't be specifically identified, it was very easy to talk because dealing with any mental health issue is very isolating. So once people felt free to talk, it was easy to have the conversations.
How did the families that you talked to go from figuring out that something was not quite right to discovering that, yes, there was anxiety that their child was feeling?
When you have a child whose anxiety has gone outside the normal realm of it's back to school, it's a fear of the dark, the normal anxieties that we see kids experience and that we expect, and it's become something that starts to take over their lives, it really does start to take over your life. And you notice it in their day-to-day functioning. Teachers start to notice it in school. You start to notice health effects as well. So as these things start to happen, you know that you have to start taking action to help your child function in their day-to-day lives.
Is there some good data out there that tells us how widespread the problem of child anxiety is?
Yes, there is. The National Institutes of Health, and I looked at the Child Mind Institute, gives us some very real statistics that as many as 1 in 5 children by the time they hit high school will have dealt with at least one severe bout of anxiety before they hit age 18, and that as many as 1 to 3 absences in high school can be related back to anxiety. Either they're just too overwhelmed to go, or there's some physical symptom manifesting itself because of anxiety.
We know that anxiety can make it difficult for people to interact. It can certainly get in the way of someone doing their job. What does it mean for a student in school if anxiety is at the point we're talking about here?
This is where it can get really difficult, and it can get difficult for teachers to recognize because it can look a little bit different for girls and for boys. In girls, we sometimes see that they'll want to push themselves to perfection, and we sometimes reward girls for that. And so parents might see the effects more at home because girls are turning in great work. They're working really hard. One of the girls in the story, it manifested itself in that she wasn't getting all her work done, though, because she was trying to do everything so perfectly, it was slowing her down. Boys, it can manifest itself in they want to be so perfect and they can already see themselves failing that they just won't do anything at all. So they get labeled as lazy. They'll get labeled as ADD. And often we'll miss their anxiety entirely, and they can get mad, and we'll see it in angry outbursts, and we will treat them for something else entirely.
So if there is a family out there that perhaps has read this story, or maybe they're listening to this interview and they say, well, there are times that I kind of wonder, what is the line where normal sort of butterflies, nervousness that all of us, experience at some point in our lives, where is that line crossed into full-blown anxiety?
Well, if we start with just this school year that we have coming up and your child is transitioning to a new school or a new teacher and they're anxious and you've done all the things that you would normally do, meeting the new teacher, talking about new routines, and we get a month into the school year and they're still staying up late. You're seeing things like stomach aches. You're seeing things like sleep disturbances, changes in attitude, changes in appetite. You're not seeing the kid that you know. Then it's time to start talk to your child's teacher. What are they seeing in school? And if things just aren't fitting together, it's a good time to start with your child's pediatrician. Just a good checkup, make sure that there's nothing physically wrong, and then have a conversation about what you might do to help.
Is anxiety something that can merely be coped with? In other words, some sort of mental exercises that a child can do that might, change their focus or in some way help them get through the day? Can it be as simple as that, I guess, is my question.
It absolutely is. Cognitive behavior therapy is what a therapist would call it, and giving your child coping mechanisms is definitely the place to start. If you think about yourself as an adult, what you do when you're anxious, if it's taking a walk to take a break, the proliferation of adult coloring books that's out there that have helped adults relax, giving your child some space to relax before you start homework, letting them listen to some music that relaxes them. And speaking from my son's point of view, the music that relaxes him is definitely not the music that relaxes me. But right. And checking in with your child, what helps you blow off some steam? And one of the things that I've learned as a parent is his video games are a way that he copes with his anxiety and it helps him. So, maybe giving a little bit of screen time, putting some parameters around it, and then it lets him relax his mind for a little bit and then start the homework. So putting in some periods of relaxation before you get back into that homework routine of your evening.
Is it important that this is sort of a multifaceted approach? In other words, you mentioned the pediatrician. You should talk to the teacher. Of course, if you are in middle school or high school, then there's many teachers to talk to. So is this something that has to be collaborative where, all of the parties involved need to talk to each other and understand where to get on the same page?
Absolutely. And maybe if your child is in middle school and high school, a good place to start might be if there's a teacher that your child has particularly good rapport with, a teacher that seems to really get your child, or a favorite teacher that your child trusts. With my son, I've asked, hey, is it okay if I email this teacher and check in? And sometimes that teacher has served as a clearinghouse to communicate with the other teachers. Hey, this is what's going on with this kid, and letting the other teachers on that child's team know. School counselors are always a great place to start. And so having a starting place, I think, is a good idea.
You're a teacher.
Yes.
How long have you been a teacher?
This is my 23rd year.
Wow. Would you say that this is something that 23 years ago, people didn't talk about much?
I would definitely say so. I think becoming more aware of it is helpful. And we still don't talk about it much. I think we're starting to talk about it more. But I think that the idea that kids could have anxiety is something that is still new to people.
Does it go beyond the point of being able to do exercises with some kids? And do you need to then look at more advanced treatment?
Yes. And the one thing that I would say to parents is that you are absolutely the best parent for your child. I think any parent who is a new parent learns that there is no shortage of people who want to give you advice. And you are the person who knows your child best. And so trusting your gut is absolutely the way to go. And you are also your child's best advocate. So I recommend starting with your pediatrician. If you think that this is a problem that's really affecting your child's life and you've talked to the teachers, starting with a pediatrician who is a great clearinghouse for recommending therapists, recommending if you do need to go the medication route. And people are very reluctant to give children and teenagers medication. So they'll try a lot of things first. And this isn't, if you feel like this is a big problem for your child, you don't have to worry that this is a lifelong sentence. But you may need a stopgap measure to help what we call break the cycle and let your child just breathe for a little while. And there's lots of temporary solutions to help your child get back on track, learn some strategies, and then pick up their regular routine and get going again.
Did the families that you talked to for the story in FYI feel that they had bridged the gap, that they were at a better place now with their kids than they were when maybe they first found that they had a condition of anxiety?
Yes. Yes. All of them had tried different strategies, and each family felt like the strategy that they had tried for their child was the right one. All were a year out, at least, from diagnosing this as a problem, and all felt like they were in a much better spot than when they had started.
So is it then a cautionary tale in some ways that you need to look out for this, but also maybe the good news is that this is something that can be dealt with in generally a pretty short time frame. We're talking here a year or so, and usually with some sort of fairly non-invasive type treatment?
Absolutely. The family that is introduced at the beginning of the article, it's a six-year-old little girl, and some of the strategies that they had for her, she tended to wring her hands a lot, and it was to the point that her hands were almost raw. So they got her some lotion with glitter on it, and so she could be more fascinated by watching the glitter, and she wasn't. And it was a very temporary thing because once the lotion was all rubbed in, she could stop. And it gave her something productive to do. She has literally a physical bag of tricks that hangs on her bedroom door that when she's feeling anxious, she can go get. She can pick out a book, a coloring activity, something to do. And a year on, she talks about her therapist as her friend and what would Miss Kelly tell me to do. So she has a vocabulary that she didn't have a year ago and is doing much better.
And that brings us to something else we should talk about here that I think we might associate anxiety with adolescence and the changes that come with teenagers. But what you're telling us in this story is that anxiety can happen at a pretty young age.
Absolutely. For this particular little girl, it started showing up at five. And so the important thing as a parent is to listen to your child and not to minimize. And I think that as parents, we don't mean to minimize, but we so much want to make everything okay. And so when we tell our children, don't worry, everything's going to be fine, to the anxious brain, their brain is saying, no, everything is not okay. And the signal that we're inadvertently giving our kids is, I shouldn't talk about it. If you just give your children a chance to talk to you and you give your child a listening ear, that goes a lot farther than telling them not to worry.
Ann Lape's story, Anxiety in Kids, can be found at fyiswmichigan.com. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ann is a teacher and writer. There's also a link to her story at wmuk.org. Thank you. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Last month, the Wisconsin State Assembly approved a $3 billion tax break for Foxconn. The company says it plans a $10 billion investment in a display panel factory. Michigan officials had hoped to lure the facility here, and now economic developers have their eye on another Foxconn project. But the senior director of the Mackinac Center's Morey Fiscal Policy Institute says that Michigan should not offer anything to try and make that happen. Michael Lefebvre's blog post for the Midland-based think tank is called Give Foxconn Nothing. Michael Lefebvre, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So if I were going to try to summarize the point you're making in this blog post, would it be wrong to say that Michigan lost the bidding war for Foxconn and that the state should declare victory and go home?
That's a great summary. I think we won by losing. The deal for Foxconn is very expensive, and it could take decades for Wisconsin taxpayers to win back the money from the Foxconn development that they've offered up to lure Foxconn to Wisconsin to begin with.
So is the price tag really your major point here, or are there some other things that bother you about the deal in general for Wisconsin?
No, the price tag is second or third on my list. I think that the top one is that these programs that hand out basically credits and subsidies to multinational corporations and others are just fundamentally unfair to those who pay the bills of government, taxpayers. And it also may very well hurt taxpayers on net balance when politicians bet on the wrong horse that don't deliver but still cost money. They also end up taking money away from public services that could use the money to create jobs and a safer community as well. There are no free lunches in the economic science. There's a famous tagline in our profession. Someone has to pay the bill, and in this case, it's taxpayers, and they pay in two ways. One, by sending money to a treasury, whether it's in Madison or Lansing, and two, by receiving some level of services back in exchange for those for that money. When government hands out subsidies willy-nilly to corporations or businesses, they have to first ultimately take it from those who are paying the bills. And so it's a question of how much in services you're going to get back when you do so.
As you note in your blog post, there was this push for the Good Jobs for Michigan program, and that there was one Lansing political operative who told the press it would be fun to create the mail piece that blames a member for losing good-paying manufacturing jobs to Wisconsin thanks to their no vote on this legislation. In reality here, is there a political consideration for policymakers that if it looks like they are letting jobs go to Wisconsin, there might be a price to pay at the polls?
There's absolutely political considerations. In fact, we have described these as political development programs more than economic development programs, because politicians care very deeply about getting elected, and that means perception is reality. So time and again, they have to ask themselves whether or not they want to be seen as anti-business by not handing out these credits. The fact of the matter is, by voting for these credits, they're actually anti-market, which is far more important. The marketplace has been creating jobs long before governments ever thought it was their job to do so. And empirical evidence from scholars with no dog in Michigan's particular fight or Wisconsin's particular fight repeatedly show that these programs are rarely as advertised. That is, they rarely deliver on the jobs that are promised, and they often cost more than they're worth. In addition to the anecdote that you just shared about the political operative, The very idea of luring a Foxconn plant was used as sort of a cudgel in the debate over whether or not to adopt this new subsidy program. And I think it was effective. And it wasn't the first time this has been done. We've seen this before, not only in Michigan, but elsewhere.
And sometimes states sort of get into a bidding war, right, where they are looking at what another state is doing and they say, well, if they're offering this, then we have to offer that. But does someone in an economic development office have to consider that at the end of the day, by not offering that, they might be not bringing jobs into the state?
And I wish they would. Unfortunately, throughout the state's last large business incentive program, a program known as the Michigan Economic Growth Authority, we saw time and again they were going after companies that were not necessarily the best economic choices, but they were great high-profile, I would say, PR or political choices. Covisint comes to mind. I saw, you know, some email traffic and public discussions about how the state absolutely had to win this company if it wanted to be not only part of the modern tech world, but part of the old automobile industry. Covisint was going to be something of an online auction for automobile parts, manufacturing parts, and that sort of thing. And it was described as this multi-billion dollar victory on our part if we could win it, and we did. And Covisint never collected on a single tax credit because they never created any of the jobs that they were supposed to within the time frame they were supposed to. And it was sold off, by the way, 15, 20 years ago for a paltry sum. So Lansing politicians and their lieutenants don't have this particular talent for picking winners from losers in the marketplace. If they did, they'd be running hedge funds on Wall Street and not working for the state. In addition, they have to factor in something that hedge fund operators don't to the same degree, and that is the politics of it all.
So the Speaker of the U.S. House, Paul Ryan, of course, he is from Wisconsin, and I think he would, you know, defend his free market bona fides against anyone else's. But he says that the deal was needed because it's going to bring high-tech jobs to their state. Should that be a consideration for state policymakers?
I think that states and local units of government jurisdictions have been creating jobs without the help of particular programs for millennia. And so it should not be a consideration, particularly when you consider that you have no way of knowing whether or not a particular industry or a particular corporation is the next big thing. In fact, we did an analysis of the state's very high-profile and expensive Michigan Economic Growth Authority program, and we looked at a range of dates on which they had handed out these tax subsidies and compared them to from the promises that were made at the time to promises that were kept. And we found that only 2.3% of the jobs that had been promised actually materialized in the time frame that they had promised. So the programs weren't that effective to begin with. And that's only a straight-up accounting. If you bring in an economist's tools, statistical tools, to the analysis, they typically perform even worse. We have found that the state's large tax incentive program in two different studies had a zero to negative impact on the state's economy.
So should the state basically end any sort of incentive programs which it has for trying to lure business or trying to convince businesses to expand in the state?
I think the state of Michigan would be far better off taking that position because it would not only distinguish ourselves from most other states, but I think the evidence shows that we'd be better off economically. If you took the amount of money that we were handing out in favors and instead of doing that, simply rolled back the corporate income tax by that amount, we would probably create as many, if not more, jobs with that approach than the one they're currently using. In fact, the Anderson Economic Group out of Lansing actually did a study where they looked at the impact of handing out these subsidies using a model called implant, and then they did a comparative analysis. They said, what if we rolled back the corporate income tax of that time by the same amount of money? How would our model, what would our model say about job creation? And on net balance, they said that there'd be more jobs created by cutting taxes for everyone instead of handing out goodies to a favored few.
The Upjohn Institute here in Kalamazoo had a study recently done by economist Tim Bardick, and we had him on the program to discuss it. He makes the argument that these tax credits are expensive, so he says that states should focus the incentives on high-paying jobs, and then they need to evaluate these programs to see if they are working, if they are actually bringing jobs to the state. Would you agree with that approach?
Yes. In fact, I've read his study, and Tim Bartik is something of a legend in our field, in economic development research and tax research. So I always read his materials. His study, I think, found that only about 6% of the economic development deals that occur across the country were actually necessary for that expansion or relocation to occur. So 94% of the deals or the expansions or locations would have happened anyway. So we need to, if the incentives are going to exist, take Tim's advice and look at the areas where they may have the highest return on investment and scrupulously review the programs when they are in operation. That is made more difficult, by the way, by the lack of transparency at the state's economic development jobs department. The Mackinac Center has fought battle after battle with them to get data we need to properly analyze economic development programs that they run. And they've put up a fight. In fact, they hire a consultant to put a return on investment figure on the state's Pure Michigan Tourism Subsidy Program. But that consultant refuses to explain precisely how he derived his return on investment calculations. And the MEDC is perfectly okay with that. They're probably happy that he refuses to explain that, and they continue to hire him. So this type of secrecy is absolutely unacceptable if we are going to maintain any of these programs, especially all of them, the way the state currently wants to.
Is part of the issue there when you're trying to get at the records and the figures that these are sort of quasi public-private agencies, so the Freedom of Information Act and that sort of thing is a little murky in terms of what they are supposed to provide to an organization like yours or to a news organization?
I would say no, because in the past, the MEDC was much more open with their records than they are today. They actually used to identify the precise corporation that was getting precisely X amount of dollars from the state. It's much harder to get that information today. The mega program, I think, is going to cost us $9 or $10 billion. It was canceled in 2011, but we're still paying out subsidies for tax credits that had not been used and are only now being presented to the state for payment. And this is one of the reasons that the governor tried to repeal this program. He said, we simply can't budget year after year not knowing what's going to happen. So it's costing our treasury, I think, $600 million this year and $500 million next year. That's pretty difficult to fund schools and other important services when you're paying out on tax credits that four of five studies have shown to be ineffective.
Is this question of business incentives, tax breaks, et cetera, a question of setting priorities? In other words, how much are you willing to spend for X number of jobs as opposed to doing something else with that money?
Yes, it always is. Unfortunately, politicians have repeatedly tried to sell this as a no-cost scenario to the people of Michigan. What they'll say is, without these incentives, the company would not be coming anyway. Therefore, it's not really costing us anything. In fact, they can't prove that the company's not coming here anyway. And in the last debate over the Good Jobs for Michigan program, in a committee hearing, a legislator actually brought up this fact to proponents of the legislation. They said a study out of the Upjohn Institute by Timothy Bartik says that only 6% of the deals you're going to be working with are affected or would happen because of these incentives. So aren't we wasting far more money and effort on these other 94%? And the proponents just talked around it. They could not get over this fact that most of these deals that happen with our money effectively would have happened anyway. And that they're just providing this free lunch or this economic icing for location cakes, courtesy of taxpayers, without any net benefit to us for doing that.
Michael DeFave is Senior Director of the Mackinac Center's Morey Fiscal Policy Institute. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Michael DeFave's blog post, Give Foxconn Nothing, can be found at mackinaw.org. A link is also available at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.